Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. This is co-host Gavin Ward alongside co-host Zach Morgan. Morning, Zach.
Yeah, good morning, Gavin.
And we are here with a returning guest, and this guest was actually in one of our very first episodes. We were actually, I think, on the beach while he was on vacation and was kind enough to welcome us, and that is often referred to as, I'm hearing, the voice of American healthcare and also healthcare futurist, Josh Luke. Josh, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Gavin and Zach. It's great to be back and on the Pop Health Podcast with y'all.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time out, Josh, to join us. We're actually recording this episode very early on a Monday morning, and really appreciate you coming out, Josh. So for those of you that don't know, Dr. Josh Luke is a former hospital CEO and actually a current caregiver for his mother, and she is dealing with Alzheimer's disease. So Josh has quite a few different perspectives as both a healthcare leader and a giver. Of care. Josh has also created the post-acute and readmissions curriculum for the Sol Price School of Public Policy there at USC, and he's also a best-selling author of the book Readmission Prevention, and that was actually the best-selling book last year from the American College of Healthcare Executives. There's a lot of other things Josh has done, including starting the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative, which many of you here listening may have been to one of those events, and also the National Bundled Payment Collaborative. So, Josh, you haven't done much. how are things going as we end the year?
Well, busy as ever. I can't believe 2017 is upon us. I actually was speaking at a Health 2.0 event in China on election night and got to watch what unfolded through international media, which in itself was an interesting experience. But like most Americans, I wasn't prepared for what unfolded that night. And I joke with folks when I speak that the person who was most surprised on election night was Donald Trump. And so watching what's unfolded since then has been fun and interesting. I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of communicating and outreach, and I'm excited to share with you today on this podcast some of the things I've learned about his appointees, Tom Price and Seema Verma. I've been exchanging some messages with Ms. Verma and had the opportunity to meet Tom Price and his staff a few years back when I was back on Capitol Hill. So I'm excited about what they bring to the table.
Awesome. I know Zach and I were actually at a retreat with some of our colleagues that night, and we stayed up quite late, and a lot of us were shocked.
Yeah, it was definitely unexpected, especially for people that work in the healthcare industry, just because it's been so front and center, and it was, you know, throughout the what was a rather, I think, to put it lightly, contentious campaign process. So I'm excited to have you here to talk about kind of what we can expect and what our audience might be able to expect.
It was like having two Game 7 World Series in 1 year, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we had different opinions in that room, so it was entertainment, I would say, for us as well. So, Josh, before we jump into kind of the election and the future of healthcare here in America, let's go on the personal side. We always like to open up a show and kind of learn something about folks that maybe when people attend your events or work with you, you know, they might see the professional side. But how about on the personal side? What's something, maybe a fun fact about you, a hobby, that type of thing?
Thanks for asking. And it's so important to keep things on the personal and human level as well. You know, I'm a child of the 80s. I love the 80s. And, you know, I'm very active on social media, as you know, and a lot of people are starting to refer to me as a healthcare social media influencer, whatever that might be. And on LinkedIn, there's a clear definition for that. But on Twitter, it's kind of cool. You get to kind of show the whole person who you are. And so on Twitter, as I've grown, I get to share that I'm a huge Dodger fan and that in high school, I played on one of the first boys volleyball teams at an inland Orange County, California school, because usually that was left for beach schools. But what I really am passionate about nowadays, other than just my family and spending time with my wife and children, is travel. I love to travel, have a boat. We hit the lakes and the rivers all summer long. But also, I love music. I love to go to concerts, mostly folks from the 80s. And it's funny because if you try to define what I love, my favorite group ever is Duran Duran. I know that sounds crazy. Usually you hear that from a a young female and not a male, but I've seen him about 7 or 8 times. My wife's learned to love him. I love to go to country concerts. I love to go to, I saw Guns N' Roses twice this summer. So across the board. And I'll say it's hard to tell my son not to listen to rap music when I grew up listening to it as well. Yeah. So I really didn't have one genre. I had a lot of them, and I love to still go to those concerts and relive those days.
Curious about Guns N' Roses. I know they played a real small show here in the L.A. area before they did a tour. Were you at that small show, or were you more at the stadium?
You know, I saw their first show back together in Las Vegas earlier in 2016, excuse me. And then when they came to L.A. Dodger Stadium, of course, many of you know my brother played for the Dodgers. So it's a real passion spot for me as well. To go see them at that venue is awesome. So I saw them twice this year, but they were both big venues.
And they still got it.
Oh, yeah. The stadium was full. At one point, I turned around because we bought grass seats. I turned around to my wife and I said, look up, Dodger Stadium was completely full. They sounded fantastic. The people there were dressed to a T. And I said to my wife, it feels like 1989 right now.
Nice. So let's jump in, now that we know a little bit about Josh's personal side, let's jump back into kind of the hot topic and the future of American healthcare. And we've heard the term healthcare futurist a bit over the past year or so. And what is a healthcare futurist?
You know, Gavin, great question. Thanks for asking it. I had actually a few people refer to me as a healthcare futurist in late 2015 and then heard it a couple more times in 2016 and then when the book Execute, a former hospital CEO tells all about what's wrong with American healthcare, was coming out, my publicist was just really interviewing me about anything and everything that he or she could market and their team could market. And that's one of the things that came up. And she said, we really need to run with this. This is true. This is what you do. You study the model. You take your experience as a CEO, not just of a hospital, but of nursing homes, assisted living, home health, and hospice, and combine that with Josh, the caregiver for your mother with Alzheimer's, Josh, the dad that, you know, has to take care of the health of his children as well, and just tell people what they can expect, not just from a personal perspective, from a business perspective. And I just shared with you as well that I was doing a radio show back east earlier in 2016, and somebody said to me, hey, you're really the voice of American healthcare because you represent the professional side and the personal side, and I think that's cool. And so whether it's a healthcare futurist or the voice of American healthcare, I take great pride and put great responsibility in either of those things. And I've found that a lot of people find them interesting. A lot of people find it a vulnerable spot to kind of give me a hard time and make light of what I do. But I've had a good track record with it. Somebody came up to me at an event last week, and I know the Pop Health Podcast was there at the event, and they said, pretty much everything you've been predicting since 2011 has been right on. And it's folks like that that give me the confidence to keep going.
Awesome. So you mentioned an event last week. It wasn't one of your events, but I know you a couple years ago created the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative and really were one of the first to put on these events kind of focused on the future of healthcare, the future of post-acute care. Tell us a little bit about the last couple of years, about what you've seen with your events and your organization, maybe some successes, some of the challenges you've seen.
Yeah, so in 2017, we're actually going to be doing 12 or 13 events, and it's going to be a lot of the cities that you've seen us in before. You're going to see us in Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Arizona, San Francisco, Philadelphia. We're going to go to Boston and Salt Lake City for the first time. So if you're in any of those markets, we're going to come back to Denver.
Dallas, I think, too.
Houston and Dallas. Yeah. I think that covers all of them. But if you're in any of those markets, the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative will be hosting events, and you can find those on our website at nationalreadmissionprevention.com. And those events this year are going to be labeled the C-Suite Invitational Transformational Healthcare. And I'm really glad you asked that question because I want to talk about the evolution of those events because Gavin and Zach and 24-Hour Home Care, you guys have been, that's your other life here besides the Pop Health Podcast. You guys have been along for that ride and been leaders in this space the whole time and seen what I've seen, which is these events brought such fanfare. In 2013 and 14 when they started, you guys may recall in Anaheim in 2014, we had 600 people show up for a one-day event. It was crazy, almost unsustainable at times. And so a lot of folks said, hey, we need to do this more often. We need to take it around the country because it's been very difficult to get acute and post-acute providers together in the same room to have this conversation. And I took great pride in that and found it somewhat of a responsibility to continue that because I've been on both sides of it. As a hospital CEO, I saw the arrogance that acute hospitals have when it comes to talking to post-acute and not engaging them in the conversation. And we're 6 years post Affordable Care Act now, and most hospitals still have limited conversations with post-acute care. And you guys know, because again, you know, when you're not doing the Pop Health podcast, working for 24-hour home care, that isn't even perceived, hasn't been perceived traditionally as part of the healthcare continuum. Right. And now it is. So the nursing homes, the long-term acute cares and acute rehabs, the home health, they couldn't even get the hospitals to engage them in conversations. And now we really quickly, because value-based care is here, have these two other spaces that we refer to as non-medical home care and assisted living that actually provide, in many cases, the best opportunity for post-acute care for a hospital and a value-based care model entering the fray. So getting everyone in the room to have those conversations is important. And I want to finish answering that question with one thought. The reason we changed the name is because in 2015, we started to see less acute people show up at those events, and it was more post-acute people. And again, as a former hospital CEO, and this is part of the reason I formed the National Bundled Payment Collaborative, because I saw that readmissions was losing its muster, if you will, in terms of attracting acute people to events. So we formed the National Bundled Payment Collaborative to co-promote the events. And I think we were very successful in getting back to about 50 to 60% ratio of our attendees being from the acute side or from an ACO or a health plan or a medical group, because without them in the room, it's difficult to have that conversation. So that's why we've changed the name to C-Suite Invitational Transformational Healthcare, because it really does attract that good mix of acute hospital executives, case managers, ACOs, health systems, all those other things that we want in the room. So it's been a great ride.
Awesome, Josh. Yeah, I know you took a risk yourself developing this organization.
Yeah.
You know, working for yourself, and congrats on the success. It's been pretty neat to be up front. I wasn't sure, you know, when you first started, how would it be, and that first event, you know, packed out. So pretty neat to see, and continuing success, hopefully, in 2017 for you. So I know Zach has a few questions, but I guess my last question would be, you've been speaking for a while. You've been in the healthcare space for quite a bit. Can you share with us maybe some risks organizations have taken, or maybe something that has been innovative where they took a risk and it's been successful, or we're starting to see success?
Yeah, and you see a lot of that. And I look at organizations like Dignity Healthcare, and I've had the honor of getting to know like Marvin O'Quinn, who's their COO, and some of their other executives over the last few years. And what I love about Dignity is I remember I was the keynote speaker at their CEO conference in 2015. And as I finished, I asked if I could just hang out and listen to each different Western region's leader present, because they have a big presence in Arizona, a presence in Southern Cal, and then a presence in Northern Cal. It was fascinating to hear, Gavin and Zach, that the things they were doing in each market in many ways were completely different. Now, in some ways, they were the same, and you could see that there was, you know, kind of the matrix organization saying we got to stay on this line. But if you weren't paying a lot of attention, you would have said they're going in completely different directions, and that fascinates me. And I've always thanked Dignity and some others. I think Cedars-Sinai would fit into this category. I think Advocate Healthcare back in the Midwest and Ascension Health are good examples of companies who have been willing to dip their toe in the water. And you know, when you do that, when in times of change, there's going to be failures as well as successes. And oftentimes we learn more from our failures than we do our successes. I know at 24-Hour Home Care, your partnership with UCLA, that is transformational. That's exciting. Those are the things that we need to see. And one of the things that I get probably 20% of my inquiries on the National Readmission Prevention website is the white paper I wrote on non-medical home care being a solution for health systems and hospitals. And at the time I wrote it, I had to really, you know, reach out and get permission from 24-Hour Home Care and two or three other organizations to kind of use their data. I don't know that I had to get permission, but because it was printed, but I wanted to cite it because I wanted to have something that appeared to be scientific, that appeared to be a white paper, that appeared to be, you know, driven by data that we could show hey, this is a solution. And it's funny because I've heard from organizations all over the country that home care companies that I'm don't even know and not familiar with and certainly haven't worked with in the past have brought that paper into the room when they're having that conversation. So that's exciting stuff. And those are all risks folks are taking. I know Brookdale Assisted Living, and they have a few SNFs, but Brookdale actually has some innovation money to do innovation grants on that side too. Right. And the conversations I've had with each of you through the years, we need to continue to push for that in home care. It's difficult because oftentimes the smaller post-acute provider, the home care company, doesn't carry the muscle that a UCLA or Cedars-Sinai would. But once we get those folks willing to pilot an initiative with us, we really need to stay focused on getting some innovation money. And not just the money. The money isn't the point. The point is bringing back the data so we can show the federal government that it's working. And that's what's exciting for me. So when people take a risk, get that data, show it to the folks, that the powers that need to see it. And we see with health plans that have the ability to make these decisions, and you guys have seen it as well, when you bring them the data, they're willing to make those decisions.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, and before we kind of switch paths here and go on to some of the changes we might see from a new administration, what was the website? Is it nationalreadmissionprevention.com?
Yeah.
So if people want to go check out the white paper or any of the things that Josh was talking about or the upcoming events, again, nationalreadmissionprevention.com, we would invite you to go and check that out. Again, the white paper is great. We've actually used it quite a bit in our own, not only research, but in program development. So we would encourage people to go and check that out. One of the things we're really excited to talk to you about, we referenced it at the beginning of the episode here, is some of the things that we might see from a new administration. Again, like you referenced, maybe that President-elect Trump was the most surprised person on election night. But I think that maybe more than most industries, the initial reverberations from the outcome have been in the healthcare industry. So much talk has been on repeal and replace, or repeal and delay of the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. First of all, before we dive too far into it, what's the difference between the concern of, say, a consumer patient and the concerns of the healthcare industry or professionals? Kind of a big picture. Where do those differences lie?
It's a great question, and I appreciate you asking it. And I think it really leads into one of the next questions we're going to talk about, which is what can we expect from a Trump cabinet and presidency? And what you can expect is an early focus on changes that are consumer focused. And, you guys have read Execute, my other book, and my students at USC, the first group just got done reading it and wrote an essay as their final. And you know what they all determined, and it made me proud because that was the goal. They said every chapter was about capitalism.
Sure.
Every chapter came back to follow the money. And I think politics is no different. So January 20th, you have a new president. By the end of February, the big push in recent presidencies has been the first 30 days and the first 100 days. So you're going to see the Affordable Care Act repealed. And repeal is a misleading word. I know I wrote an article on LinkedIn about late November that went viral saying they can't repeal it, number one. Number two, within 48 hours of being elected, Trump said he wasn't going to repeal the whole thing because he was going to leave the pre-existing condition clause and the kids up to 25. Mm-hmm. But the Republicans are going to claim victory that they repealed it within 30 days
sure.
of the inauguration, which is fine because that's when the conversation is really going to begin. They're going to take one or two things that were already vulnerable, most likely the exchanges, which were failing by everybody's accord long before the election. Make a change and declare that they ended Obamacare and raise their hands and high five. And hopefully at that point, as Americans as a whole, we can move on. And there's been so much decisiveness and divisiveness on this issue. Even the article I referenced a second ago, it was completely non-ideological and apolitical, and almost every comment was for or against and very passionate.
Sure.
So I'm hopeful that we can have educated conversations about every issue. One of the things that both Tom Price, who was President-elect Trump's appointee nomination to direct Health and Human Services Department, and Seema Verma, President-elect Trump's nominee to lead the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they both have a history of being willing to cross the aisle to get things done. And if you read a little deeper into their backgrounds, it's not just a history of crossing the aisle, but it's a desire to include those folks in the conversation. And as I've done research, guys, because this, wow, what a fascinating political time in our country. I'm not somebody who's ever been, you know, in love with politics and loves following it, but I've gone back and done some reading on Donald Trump because I wanted to know who he really was before the media had a responsibility to cover him. And I've also read a lot of op-eds about what makes a good president. And I read one recently that said Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, who obviously from two different sides of the aisle, which I appreciated that the writer shared that, both of their successes were built on Ronald Reagan would not sign a deal without some Democratic support. And Bill Clinton had a penchant for closing deals and being willing to cross the aisle to get deals done. And they were the two most popular presidents of our time by most people's accord. So I appreciated that. And I think the point of the article was, even though President-elect Trump may have a majority and can make changes with an ink pen, we're going to learn really quickly how that went over the last 8 years with President Obama. Because when you do things on your own with an ink pen, and then the White House changes over, they're all going to get undone with an ink pen just as quickly. And so collaborate, cross the aisle, get things done. And kind of the long-winded answer to your question is the early discussions are going to be about consumer-focused issues like access,
sure,
affordability. And one of the articles I'm preparing now and reaching out to talk to folks like you to get your input on is what will the history books say about the Affordable Care Act? And I can narrow it down in my estimation right now to two bullet points. It expanded access. And the second bullet point would be at the expense of everyone. Everyone I know had their expenses go up. And the only people that might be the exception to that are those who didn't have care to start with, or those who were very sick, which, as we all know, up until about the election time, were really the only folks who'd enrolled,
yeah,
for the most part, in the Affordable Care Act. So I think its legacy, unfortunately, isn't going to be a great one from that perspective.
Sure. Just because it's being tossed around, I think, a lot more now as we're recording this, what exactly is repeal and delay? Because it sounds like it's like you said, a decision in the first 30 days, but then maybe not necessarily any action taken for a while as something comes out. So there can be, you know, a decision that something was repealed. And is that kind of accurate? Is that what it kind of means? Because that's a new term for, I think, a lot of people.
Well, yeah, I don't know how much time we have to break that down and define it. But what I think the point is they're going to celebrate overturning and repealing something that they're really only going to overturn 1-2% of. And then the good news is it sounds like they're going to have a logical conversation about, sure, each item, and they're going to involve everyone and hopefully come to a logical conclusion. And I would also think that really get back to the heart of what the ACA was. It was an expansion of access.
Right.
As providers, we want to say, and this is another thing I'm spending a lot of time writing about now and speaking about, is value-based care is not synonymous with the Affordable Care Act. Now, the ACA had a ton of value-based care. It was, from a provider perspective, it was absolutely entrenched in alternative payment models and value-based care. But one thing is constant, and Tom Price will tell you this, Seema Verma will tell you this, we will not be going back to fee-for-service, because there's one simple fact that no one can escape. And we all remember being young and in college or out of high school when our checking accounts were empty. Well, the federal Medicare checking account is empty, and it's being drained at an alarming rate, and that's not changing. So value-based care and alternative payment models are here to stay. I do think Tom Price is going to slow down mandated innovation programs and bundled payment programs and things like that. I'm hopeful, because the narrative always changes when you go from being on the side that's losing to not just being in charge on the side that's winning, but really being in charge with the ability to do whatever you want. I'm hopeful that a deep breath will be taken and say, hey, even though I've been, you know, Tom Price has been publicly adamantly against mandated innovation programs like the cardiac bundled payment.
Comprehensive care for joint replacement, CJR program, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and before that, comprehensive care for joint replacement. And really his argument's been they're coming too fast, we don't know enough. I think what Dr. Price may not know what we know on the other side is these hospitals won't implement these things unless they're mandated.
Right.
With very, very few exceptions. So I'm hopeful that cooler heads will prevail and they will incentivize those who do willingly participate, because as we know, it's going to take that
right.
to get them there. So I'm hopeful that there will not be a cancellation of comprehensive joint replacement. I think that would be irresponsible, quite frankly, and I think most people would agree with that. I do think you're going to see the cardiac bundled payment program be non-mandatory,
yeah.
voluntary, and tweaked to hopefully, I would think they would incentivize those folks to say, hey, if you do get in the game, we'll give you a little bit of a bonus to participate. Because what we need, again, and it came back to this earlier, is the data. We need to see if these things are working.
Right. And I think that that's you hit on a really hot topic, at least that we see in the healthcare industry, and it's with value-based payments, because a lot of patients might not realize how much their healthcare delivery system has been changing over the last couple of years. But you mentioned it. I mean, hospitals and health systems completely changing and innovating new ideas going towards the value-based care. And so it will be interesting, I think, to see how that looks as we continue to move forward, because it would be a huge change and issue to try to just completely reverse course. I do want to just so people know, so with the bundled payment for care initiatives, that was a voluntary bundled payment program. We've talked about this. Josh obviously kind of wrote the book, so to say, on some of that stuff. And then the mandatory bundles were first with the comprehensive care for joint replacement, so for CJR, and possibly cardiac bundles coming up. Josh and I were actually at a conference the other day that some people still feel that there will be these mandatory bundles coming up, but from everything that I've read too, the mandatory might be the most vulnerable part. And that is, you'd mentioned him a little bit, Tom Price. He's an orthopedic surgeon, and he is tapped to be the Secretary for Health and Human Services. One thing that you had touched on is that he actually has shown in the past that he appreciates the move away from a fee-for-service model, right? And so he might be willing to see some of the value-based plans moving forward.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you touched on this, Zach, because a lot of people will read the first two lines of an article and move on from it. I think we're all guilty of that in the information age. But when you really drill down on Tom Price, so he's an orthopedic surgeon from Georgia. I had the opportunity to meet with his staff a couple years ago. I'm fortunate enough to be on the advisory board for the National Transitions of Care Coalition and head back to D.C. once or twice a year to meet with some of our congressmen and congresswomen to make sure they're keeping an eye on population health and advocating for it. And what you'll learn about Tom Price is, while he's a staunch critic of the Affordable Care Act, I think as a Republican you had to be, for starters, okay?
Sure.
What that didn't mean is that he was he's a supporter of value-based care, as you mentioned. So a lot of people, again, that's kind of the first sign for a lot of people who thought those were the same term. They're not. They're separate. And again, he's an opponent of mandated alternative payment models. He's been an outspoken critic, and this I know is hard for the three of us because we're such big fans of it, of Medicare's Innovation Center.
Right.
You know, and I think, as I read, it's just because of the mandates. Well, there's two things. It's because of the mandates, and he thinks they've been given undue power to kind of act on their own without guidance. And so you're going to see them kind of brought under the umbrella of somebody else's leadership. I was fortunate enough to present with the executive director, the head person from the Innovation Center in Nashville at the Post-Acute Evolution Summit a few months ago, and she, Amy Bassano, just a neat, fascinating lady that knows her stuff so well, and is somebody that would be a great guest for you, because one of the questions I put to her, I said, Amy, tell me about this waiver for comprehensive care for bundled payment joint replacement program. Who's using it? What are they using it for? Is it home care? Is it assisted living? Is it iPads? And she said, actually, you know, whatever. What we wanted to do was allow hospitals and health systems to be creative, because we see all the solutions out there and we recognize that healthcare is so local. But what a lot of folks don't understand is that they have to put that waiver in there, because if you spend Medicare dollars on a non-Medicare participant, that's against the law.
Right.
So putting a waiver in there allows them, the health system, the freedom to say, hey, we do want to partner up with a home care company and maybe pay for a safe ride home. And you hear people say door to door. Well, as you guys know better than anybody, that doesn't get it done. In your business, the home care business, it's bed to bed. And what you guys have really, you guys being 24-hour home care, your other life have been the best at for many years, is understanding that the real difference you make is when you do get into the home is letting the patient and what I refer to as the alpha daughter who's making the decisions, letting them know that they're better off with you in the room.
Right.
And, you know, I know in my experience in chatting with you guys and others in the industry, it's, hey, put your best caretaker on that Safe Ride Home program and make sure the family and the alpha daughter falls in love with you, because when you leave, whether it's that one day if you're just doing the Safe Ride Home or 3 or 4 days if you're doing a few follow-ups, you want them to know that they can't live without you. And what's interesting, too, is you've seen assisted living and home care really emerge, and in some cases one's more affordable for families, in other cases another is. And I see that with my mother right now. You know, my family's debating assisted living or an evening caretaker because my dad's health starting to suffer as well.
Sure. Well, I'm really glad that you brought up the Center for Medicare, Medicaid, the Innovations Center that they have. We are almost out of time, and we appreciate you you coming in to talk with us, but I was actually going to specifically ask you about that because you had mentioned that in your talk the other day. Can you just give people an idea, for those who might be uninitiated, what is the Innovation Center at Medicaid? Because it's kind of a new, and frankly, it's been a pleasure to work with them, and they've been finding some really interesting things. So just can you briefly let people know kind of what it is?
Yeah, it's exciting, and it's fun. And let me give you kind of the 30,000 foot observation on the CMMI is what they're referred to. And just go look them up and read, because it would be really hard to describe it even in 5 minutes. But initially, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, they were a lot more focused on us taking their ideas and implementing them. And I think within a few years, they said, okay, can you guys give us some ideas too? And we'll vet them and give you guys some money. And so what we learned about those, that willingness for them to give us grants, was they don't want an idea, they want proof that it works. And, you know, 24-hour home care has been a great example of an organization who had that proof, and maybe you guys had to repackage it to get it to them. But
the first time we approached them, they said, what is home care?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know what? That's great, though, because it started the conversation. It started it down the right path. When I actually asked Amy what they intended about Amy Bassano from CMMI, what they intended with that waiver, she said, gosh, I think we were thinking about iPads in the home, but really we just wanted to open it up because we knew there was a lot of innovation out there. So go online and check it out. And I think you're going to see some changes in their freedom to release new programs. And it has been, I think we'd all acknowledge they've been doing a lot the last 2 years.
Yep.
So if they're kind of slowed down a little bit, it's probably not a bad thing. I think what we're all a little worrisome of is that they would slow down the requirement of hospital and health system participation, because we have not seen a huge willingness by health systems to participate voluntarily. I do think that's changing. You know, I will just wrap up this question, guys, by saying part of the reason, as I mentioned earlier, I formed the National Bundled Payment Collaborative in 2015 is because I didn't see hospitals prioritizing readmissions as much as I would have liked them to. And I will tell you, I don't get caught off guard a lot in population health because I feel like I'm reading and staying out in front and socializing with experts like you guys as regularly as I can to stay on top of it. And that is one of the things that makes me stronger, is making sure I'm staying in touch with what you guys are seeing as well. But what I'll tell you is 2016 was the first year that hospitals truly put readmissions as a priority. And that caught me off guard, but it was exciting. Because remember, I pivoted away from readmission slightly to make sure I was keeping them there. And now because of, you know, the next obvious question would be, well, why all of a sudden? And you guys have seen my slide. I have 7 different alternative payment programs I put on one slide, 7 bullet points that say, well, because all of these alternative payment programs and penalties get back to the same thing, right care, right place, right time for the right patient. And that means if you're admitting a patient unnecessarily, you're not going to be paid, and you're going to be penalized at every level of care.
Absolutely. And I hope, and I think we can all agree that we hope that that focus can stay regardless of what the future of the Affordable Care Act looks like. Josh, thanks so much for sitting down with us. One thing, we hopefully once we get kind of a clearer picture of what everything looks like once the administration has turned over and some things start passing, we'd love to have you back. Again, you are one of the more knowledgeable, if not the most knowledgeable, in kind of the connection between post-acute and the acute world. I would love to have you back to talk about some more of that. And thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, and just lastly, for those who want to keep up with Josh, feel free to check out nationalreadmissionprevention.com. Josh, any other links you'd like to share
with the
audience?
What's the Twitter handle, too?
The Twitter handle is JoshLuke4Health, the number four, so JoshLuke4Health. Yeah, I have a lot of fun on Twitter. On LinkedIn, if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, I post two or three articles a day, mostly written by others that are relevant. And if you're in California or even nationally, guys, we're going to have the second annual USC C-Suite Invitational May 4th in downtown L.A. So far, we have Rod Hanners, the CEO of Keck, on board, and we're hoping to make a really big announcement about a big-time CEO from back east who's going to be willing to come out and talk a little bit about genomics and population health at the health system he's running back east now as well. So
excellent.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. So again, folks, thanks for joining this episode of Pop Health Podcast. Quick shout out, Zach, your Twitter handle?
At Pop Health Zach.
And mine as well is at Gavin Pop Health. You can also download us on iTunes. Again, if you're listening, you like the show, please go ahead and like us on iTunes. These likes and the downloads do help us get guests like Dr. Luke and the other folks that we've had. You can also stream us at pophealthpodcast.com. Thanks so much, everybody. Take care.